Now, let us proceed much more briefly to the next three lectures. In the second lecture, we studied the axial age. That is to say, we studied that very rich, that very productive, that very glorious period, 600-year period, from 800 BC to 200 BC. And we saw that this was the period of human history when the higher evolution really began. We saw that it was a period of intense spiritual awakening, of intense spiritual creativity, practically over the entire civilized world. We saw, for instance, that in China, it was the age of Confucius and Lao Tzu. In India, of the Buddha, of Mahavira, and the Upanishadic sages. In Persia, of the great prophet Zarathustra. And in Palestine, of the Hebrew prophets. In Greece, again, it was the period, the age of Socrates, Plato, their followers, friends, and contemporaries. And we saw further that all these figures, whether of China, whether of India, Persia, Palestine, Greece, we saw that all these great figures, all these towering personalities, had certain things in common, certain great characteristics in common. We saw that above all, they were and are all individuals. We saw that they stood out and still stand out from the mass. Not just members of the mass, not just members of the herd. We saw that they stood out, that they all were, in fact, what we called new men. We saw that all had started, have started, in greater or lesser degree, on the higher evolution of man. And we saw, therefore, further that the axial age is of importance as the age of the emergence of the new man. And we closed this particular lecture by studying, in some detail, some of the characteristics of the new man. We saw that the new man is characterized by self-consciousness or awareness, by true individuality, by creativity, by aloneness, and only too frequently also by unpopularity. Then in the third lecture we dealt with another great phase of this whole subject of the higher evolution of man, dealt with art and the spiritual life. And by art we meant all the fine arts. Spiritual life, of course, corresponding to the higher evolution itself. And we saw in the course of this lecture, tried to illustrate in the course of this lecture, that the true artist too was a species of new man, and that he shared the characteristics of the new man. We studied too the nature of art itself. We saw that art could be defined as the organization of sensuous impressions that express the artist's sensibility and communicate to his audience a sense of values that can transform their lives. And the greater part of that lecture was an exposition, in fact, of this definition. We saw, for instance, that the true artist has access to higher states of consciousness, higher modes of being than the ordinary man. And we saw, too, how this all worked out in terms of our chart. We tried to see just where the artist stands. And we were concerned in this connection with the two middle sections of our chart, that is to say, from point one to point three. In other words, we were concerned with the higher section of the lower evolution and with the lower section of the higher evolution. And for the sake of clarity, we transferred this particular section to a separate chart. And on this separate chart, we saw that the line 1, 2, 3 represents, within the general evolutionary process, the scale of artistic development. And like the previous chart, this chart, or the hypotenuse on this chart, is divided by point 2. In other words, the point of the emergence of self-consciousness, distinctively human consciousness in the higher sense. And then we saw that each of these sections, these two sections, can be subdivided, so that we have point 1A there and point 2B there. 1A represents the average consciousness, the average human consciousness, halfway between the lowest human consciousness, represented by point 1, and the what we may describe as self-consciousness in the more highly developed human sense. Point 2B here represents the highly artistic consciousness, the consciousness of the true artist or even of the artistic genius. In this way we find this section of the hypotenuse 2 divided into four sections. And section A, we saw, was the section or stage of no art at all. B was folk art. C was the level of the fine arts. And D was the level of supreme artistic achievement. And we saw further that the majority of artists, the majority of artistic work, fell into the section 2 to 3, the majority of artists coming in C, and just a few in D, a very few indeed, of whom just a few, again, perhaps penetrated, at least sometimes, even beyond point 3. Now, last week we studied religion, ethnic and universal, and once again we covered an immense amount of ground. Now, we took as our starting point, you may remember, the question of the disappearance of Buddhism from India. We saw that there were five principal reasons for this. One, centralization of monastic life. Two, dependence on and eventual failure of royal patronage. Three, hostility of the Brahmins. Four, partial absorption of Buddhism by Hinduism. And five, the Muslim invasion. And we then went on to consider the characteristics of ethnic religion and the characteristics of universal religion. We saw that ethnic religion was basically collective, practiced by man not as an individual, but as a member of a group, of a community. And we saw that the second, that it was a universal religion, was individual, practiced by the individual as such, not practiced by the individual as member of a group. We then proceeded to classify existing religions. We saw that Hinduism, Judaism, Confucianism and Shinto, for instance, were all ethnic religions and that they belonged as such to the lower evolution of man. Then we saw that Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Christianity, Islam were universal religions and belonged, therefore, to the higher evolution. We touched on various other points as well. We saw that universal religions always arise in the midst of ethnic religions, and that they are in some sense continuous with them. The universal religion speaks the language, as it were, of the ethnic religion in whose midst it arises. In so doing, it refines that language, but at the same time there is a danger, and that danger being embodied in the rule or the law, if you like, that a universal religion becomes, inevitably it seems, in course of time, transformed into an ethnic religion, becomes not individual any longer, but collective. We saw that this had happened with Christianity, saw it had happened with Buddhism, due to the operation of what I called the gravitational pull. At the same time, we saw the universal religion cannot cut itself off completely from the ethnic. The universal religion has its roots deep down in the ethnic, just as the higher evolution has its roots in the lower evolution. We saw, too, the importance of continuity, how that it was important that the universal religion should be in complete continuity with the ethnic religion, so that one can look back, as it were, over one's previous spiritual religious history, the spiritual, the religious history of the community, of the nation, and trace it right back to the beginnings. And we saw that, so far as the West is concerned, that continuity of religious life had been sadly interrupted by militant Christianity, which sought to destroy paganism wherever it penetrated. And we saw too that nowadays it is important for us in the West to try to establish or re-establish contact with our pre-Christian pagan roots. And I even went so far as to say that there must be, in a sense, a revival of paganism, and that only then could Buddhism flourish on the principle of no root, no flower. And it was on this rather provocative note that we closed last week. So much for the first four lectures. I'm sorry to have hurried you through all this material so rapidly, but we really must get on now to the subject matter of the evening.